Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Dr. Dorothy Armstrong, historian of the material culture of South, Central, and West Asia. And we're talking about her new book, Threads of Empire, A History of the World in 12 Carpets. Dorothy, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very glad to be here.
This is one of those books, I don't get it a lot, but there's a book where I thought I knew what the book was going to be like, and then you read it, and it's so much more interesting than you thought it was going to be. And then it got really wild. And you talk about this in the beginning of the book, when did you first fall in love with what you call the subversive power of carpets? Which is a phrase I bet most people didn't think they'd ever hear.
I was given a carpet or lent a carpet when I was an undergraduate in Cambridge. I had a friend who was a translator of Arabic literature. And so he had a great many fascinating Asian objects and African objects. And this carpet was too big for his flat in Cairo's Garden City. So he lent it to me because I had some space. And I became totally obsessed with it. And so for me, it really was a coup de foudre. I saw this carpet. It was extremely meaningful to me. I was at the time studying history and English literature. I was an undergraduate. And this carpet just meant so much more to me than the European history I was studying or the artifacts of English literature that I was studying. So it was quite early on in my life. Life took me in other directions, but it was there from a long time ago.
I assume that you first fell in love with the visual appeal and the sort of tactile appeal of these this carpet. But when did you first sort of connect it to the historical and political parts?
I think that was there from pretty early on as well. I mean, one of the wonderful things about going to university, this is why university is so important for young people, it's not to get them better jobs, is that you meet a fascinating and cosmopolitan set of people. So I was suddenly, having lived in an industrial town in the north of England, I was suddenly in a group of people who came from all over the world and had all kinds of different cultural backgrounds. So I was already in a period of waking up to the fact that there was a lot more than the factories and the mills and the rugby league club of Wigan, where I was born and brought up. So I think from quite early on, not only were they fantastically sensuous and aesthetically riveting objects for me, they were also a pathway into understanding a broader world.
One of the first things, and there are many themes in your book, is there's such a disconnect between the cultures and the people who make the carpets and the people who later own and display the carpets. And I want to talk about we assume that most of these traditional carpets, these traditional weavers, were women, correct?
Yeah.
Now, the people who end up owning them are often people who are responsible for the subjugation of other people, because these carpets are prized. They become objects that people have to have. And this book really explores that story. And it takes really fascinating and interesting digressions. You really go down a number of rabbit holes here. And I love the fact that you did this. Let's talk about where a lot of these carpets come from. It's from areas sort of between Russia, Asia, in the Middle East. It's countries like Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. And it's places that were along the traditional Silk Road, right?
Yeah, and Iran and Anatolia also. Yeah. And the Caucasus. So creeping into what we now think of as Europe.
But it's fascinating where the carpets that are created in that place, these places, where they end up. Like the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Yes, this is one of the most extraordinary characteristics of carpets, is that they are transformed from the work of humble people often illiterate, usually economically marginal. There's a wonderful book called The World is a Carpet, where a US journalist spent a year in an Afghan village while they wove their carpet. And that carpet took the entire surplus of that village for the entire year that they were weaving it. So these are people who do not play the power game of the world, but there is something about the artifacts that they produce which triggers a very profound status greed in the elites of the world. And so this transformation from the products very often of village or nomadic humble folk into propaganda instruments for the great of the world, it's one of the most mysterious things in material culture. Okay, so if you're making ceramics in Arisa in Japan, or in Jinjiang in China, or in Iznik in Anatolia, you know that's a government-organized enterprise.
Right.
And you know that what you're making is going into an elaborately evolved social world. But if you're a carpet maker on the plains of Anatolia or in Turkmenistan, you're making it basically for yourself. So it's not the same kind of process of production that you would get for very fine ceramics. Sure, the people are humble who make them. Sure, they're economically marginalized. Sure, they don't themselves participate in the power politics of the world. But the guys who are organizing those huge kilns are part of that system, whereas there is a total separation between the weaver and the where the carpet ends up.
There's no way we can cover all the aspects in this book at all. Every chapter is worth a separate interview. But I want to touch on a couple of things. The oldest carpet in your book, which dates back from the 3rd to the 4th century BCE, the place of production of it is unknown, and it's called the Pazyryk, and please forgive my mispronunciation, the Pazyryk carpet. It's in the Hermitage Museum. Let's talk about that. I mean, this is a ridiculously old carpet, yet it's absolutely stunningly beautiful.
And almost complete. It's got one tattered corner. Ecology plays an enormous part in the lives and biographies of carpets as well. So this is effectively a carpet that we only have because of the ecology that it was buried in. So the Scythians were a great race of warriors who moved across the steppe, who defeated the Persian Empire, who lasted throughout the Iron Age. And the Pazyryk is in the Altai Mountains of Siberia. And in Pazyryk are the royal tombs of the Scythian warriors, their chieftains, their khans, their kings. So the Pazyryk carpet was buried with one of the great chieftains. And it could have been stolen by grave robbers. It wasn't, because the Scythians also had wonderful metalwork, gold and silver, and that was taken by grave robbers. But the textiles scrunched up in a corner of the tomb, the grave robbers missed them. But what the grave robbers did do was let in muddy water into the tomb. That water froze, and consequently, for 1,500 years, the carpet was just preserved as if it were in a freezer.
Now,
so when it was finally taken out of the ground after various other vicissitudes in the 1940s, it was pretty much whole. So it comes from a time in the world that we can barely imagine now. The Scythians were nomads. They were moving along the Silk Roads, but they were also a significant empire. And this is one of the things that carpets constantly re-emphasize when we start to think about them historically, that nomads were also empires. You know, these were not people scrabbling for a living. They were also great territorial empires.
And we don't know that much about Scythians as a people because they left no texts.
And they leave no texts. They leave no texts, but they were recorded by Herodotus.
Well,
in a very colorful way.
I know. I fell in love with Scythian women. Sounded great.
Scythian women, oiled, rubbed with.
Everybody's getting drunk and high.
Cream. They're all smoking hemp. That's it, exactly.
But Dorothy, for a minute, because I want to make sure we touch on other things. Nothing's this simple in your book, because it's not just the story of this carpet and the Scythians. It's really the story of Sergei Rudenko.
Yes, and Stalin.
And Stalin.
One of the things actually that were a surprise to me when I was writing was how often Stalin played a part in the story of these carpets. So yes, Sergei Rudenko was a leading archaeologist in Russia at an unfortunately interesting time, the beginning of the 20th century. So when the Soviets came to power, of course, with the most tremendous energy, I mean, you stand back in awe at this energy, they attempted to control everything, including history. And so Rudenko found himself, surprisingly, you know, he was an archaeologist who was digging up old tombs in Siberia, found himself at the center of a huge political and ideological controversy. So he was digging up elite relics of chieftains. And what the Soviet Union wanted from its historians and from its archaeologists was the story of the history of the proletariat, the economic struggle between classes. Now, Rudenko couldn't offer them that. All he could offer them was the Pazyryk carpet, fabulous gold and silver metalwork, done by this nomadic empire of chieftains. And he became, he was classified as an enemy of the people. He was imprisoned, and the excavations were closed. This was in 1929 as Stalin came to power. But he had a very charmed and cursed life. He knew a lot about ice because he had been digging in the permafrost of the Arctic Circle. You know, these graves were in the north of Siberia. And so he knew about ice, and two great projects required that knowledge. One was Stalin's White Sea Canal, in which huge, it was like the Burma railway line. It was an appalling sacrifice of human life to build this canal. And the other was the Road of Life across Lake Ladoga during the siege of Leningrad, where trucks, sleds, horses crossed Lake Ladoga to get food into the starving people of Leningrad by a back route that the Germans hadn't taken. And because Rudenko had by then earned a reputation as being very knowledgeable about ice, he wasn't killed like some of his colleagues who were archaeologists. He was put onto the Road of Life to do the ice forecast. And so he came out of the Second World War, and by 1947, things had shifted in the Soviet view of history, and he was allowed to go back and carry on with his excavations. And it was only then, in 1947, that he found our Pazyryk carpet. He hadn't found it by the time that Stalin had closed the sites down in 1929. So it's an amazing participant in one of the great upheavals of the 20th century, but the revolution in Russia and then the part that Russia played in the Second World War.
The story is really amazing because this whole thing about the Scythians, the contemporary Soviets or the relatively recent historical Soviets become enamored of the idea that they're descended from the Scythians, right up to Putin. Putin, who sort of sees himself as a modern-day Scythian chieftain.
He does. And there's a complex of ideas that come together here, because Russia has right-wing nationalists who are more extreme than Putin. I'm amazed to hear myself saying this. But they are very committed to the idea that the whole of Eurasian culture, and hence the whole of global culture, in their view, stemmed from the Scythians, from the Arctic peoples. And although one has a kind of visceral reaction against this because of the people who promulgate this idea, who are dangerous people, one of the weird things that is currently happening is that the geneticists who are looking at the common ancestors of indigenous peoples of North America and the Turks, right, who are interested in whether or not there was a transfer, a genetic transfer of people across the Bering Strait, find that the Turkish people who were in along the Silk Roads and the indigenous North Americans have shared DNA. And their proposal is that the common ancestor came from the Arctic Circle, from Siberia. So there are many complex, unresolved historical and political issues sitting behind the Scythians. And we know almost nothing about them. They're not part of our ordinary discourse.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Dr. Dorothy Armstrong, historian of the material culture of South, Central, and West Asia. And we're talking about her new book, I strongly recommend it, Threads of Empire, A History of the World in 12 Carpets. You know, speaking of Stalin, one of your chapters is about the meeting in Yalta and the carpet that's there that was brought by Stalin. And it really was like a show of power in a weird way.
Well, people standing on carpets is a long tradition. And carpets are not particularly in their places of making and usage, their original places of making and usage. They're not particularly associated with floors. You know, they're used as drapes, they're used as the walls of the tent, they're used as beds, they're put on tables. Standing on a carpet has always had a strong significance and has always represented domination. So there's a very famous, it's actually a painting of a mural of Henry VIII. It was on the wall of Whitehall, but now there's a painting of it. And many people who are listening to this, I'm sure, have seen it. Henry is in all his finery, in middle age, standing with his feet apart on an Ushak carpet of Anatolia. And this, of course, is exactly the moment when two things are happening. One, Henry is breaking away from the Pope. And two, the Ottomans are continuously encroaching on Europe. So this is a moment of great symbolic authority. Look here, Pope. Here I am standing on an Ottoman carpet. Not only can we see off the Ottomans, but I can see off you. The association is very strong. And in the photograph of the Yalta conference, which many people will have seen, Stalin, Roosevelt, Churchill, sitting on ordinary dining chairs outside this very bashed about gutter in Yalta, because, of course, Yalta was absolutely destroyed by the Germans. And they have the only thing that they had to make this into an impressive, imperial, victorious moment was a carpet. It's not a very grand carpet. It's rather pale. It sits beneath their feet. Roosevelt and Churchill are wearing shoes, but Stalin is wearing military boots, and they're planted firmly on this white carpet. So I do make an attempt to try and track where this carpet came from. And one tantalizing idea is that it came in Stalin's personal train and that it may have been a particular personal domestic favorite of Stalin's, but we don't know.
There's so many other things to talk about, and we're going to run out of time because it's ticking back. There are a lot of, there's the whole thing about museums and carpets and museums and power. There's one of my favorite stories in this book has to do with the carpet scholar May Beattie.
Nabiti, yes.
And Getty.
And, oh, yes.
Now, we're not going to talk about it because it's going to take too long to describe that story, and we're going to run out of time. But what a wild story, and that really sums up the situation with people who are carpet scholars versus museums and rich people who collect carpets. And yeah. That's a whole other issue that weaves in it, no pun intended, in and out throughout this book, too.
And museums are embodiments of power themselves. So it's not just that rich people and museums are, that it isn't that museums are protecting knowledge against depredations of rich people. Museums are trying to embody the power of the imperial states that set them up. So they too have agendas, and there are episodes in the book, not only of rich collectors getting very angry when scholars question their the attribution of their carpets, but museums getting very angry about the same problem.
Hmm. In the case of, I really came to admire May. She's in and out of your book throughout the length of the book. Did you ever get a chance to meet her?
No, but there is an autobiographical element for me for this. So she died in 1987, I think.
Okay.
And she gave all her carpets. They're not tremendously distinguished, but they're a very lovely snapshot of what carpets you could get if you were a traveler at that time, but also all her working notes, all her photographs. She gave it to the Ashmolean Museum. And she gave the Ashmolean Museum enough money to fund a research fellowship. And I was the May Beatty Fellow.
Oh, wow.
So although I never met May Beatty personally, I lived with her full-time for a year and then part-time after that as I broadened my interest in other areas. But I spent a year looking through all her personal correspondence, all her diaries. So she's partly present because she's been so important in my life. But she was also a leading figure in the development of carpet studies in the later 20th
yes,
century,
yes.
And is still revered.
There are so many interesting juxtapositions in this book, too. And I'm going to end. We just have enough to talk about this. But one of my favorites is, why did the plain, unadorned Lutherans in Brasov, Transylvania, you know, who really didn't want any adornment in their churches whatsoever, they ended up keeping so many elaborate Islamic rugs safe for
amazing.
So many years? That was one of the wildest stories in this of a very wild book, but that juxtaposition was wild.
And I have a theory. I mean, I've been unembarrassed in this book about expressing my own theories. I've lived with these carpets. I've thought about them a lot. And some things have come to me almost in a kind of trance-like state. So having pondered long on this whole issue of what were the Lutherans doing collecting these carpets, I thought about Transylvania, home of Dracula, still a great home of profound folk magic and folk beliefs. And this increasingly came to feel to me like a culture that was just unusually spiritually attuned, that it was a whirlpool of different beliefs. So you could be a Lutheran preacher, but you would communicate at the local market with people who believed in folk religions. You would know the stories of the vampires and the female hunters who steal the spirits of men, even if you're a Lutheran preacher, because this is a kind of whirlpool of spirituality. So given that you've got that sensitivity, Islamic culture, Islamic religion, it's not such a big step. Although it does seem crazy at first, I agree.
Well, maybe it's beat, and I'm going to end on this note. It may be beaten out by the story of the flat-woven kilim from the 16th century Iran, how it ends up in a war vest of a Japanese warlord. That was another crazy story. And you're going to need to read the book to see all the threads that connect these things together. My guest tonight has been Dr. Dorothy Armstrong. historian of the material culture of South Central and West Asia. And we've been talking about her new book. It was surprisingly just wild. Threads of Empire, a history of the world's in the of the world in 12 carpets. Dorothy, it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.